If you are putting together a piece of furniture from like a flat pack box, or maybe you're baking a cake, there is this comforting baseline expectation of explicit instructions.
Right. Yeah. It's totally deterministic.
Exactly. I mean, you insert tab A into slot B, or you bake at 350 degrees for 30 minutes, and well, the result is exactly what is pictured on the box. You
Yeah.
follow the rules, you get the outcome.
It is a very safe way of interacting with the world, honestly. And, software engineering has operated on the exact same principle for decades.
Right.
A programmer writes a rule like, if the user clicks this button, load this page, and the machine just mindlessly executes the command.
But then you step into the world of machine learning, and suddenly you are just throwing that entire instruction manual out the window.
Oh, completely.
We are looking at a landscape where the system isn't just following a flowchart anymore. It's actually writing the rules itself based on what it observes.
Yeah, we are fundamentally moving from giving machines instructions to, well, giving them experiences.
Which is wild to think about.
Yeah.
And that paradigm shift is exactly what we are unpacking today for you. We are digging into an incredibly dense, comprehensive guide from AI MLOps Masters.
It's a fantastic resource.
It really is. It covers all the foundational mechanics of machine learning and data science. And our mission here for this deep dive is to like strip away the intimidating terminology and just get to the absolute core of how these systems function.
Right, because there's a lot of jargon.
Tons of it. We want to give you a highly intuitive understanding of how algorithms actually learn, how we prepare the raw information we feed them, and most importantly, how we measure if they're actually succeeding or just tricking us.
Yeah, that last part is crucial.
So consider this your shortcut to being the most informed person in your next strategy meeting, or satisfying your own curiosity about the systems that are kind of running our lives now.
To really grasp the material in this guide, we have to totally let go of the idea of traditional programming. I mean, machine learning relies on algorithms that ingest data, identify underlying patterns, and uncover these hidden relationships to make decisions dynamically.
Right, it's not static.
Exactly. It improves its performance over time without a human ever going in and like tweaking the code.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can look at the complex algorithms themselves, we first need to understand the fundamental ways we actually teach these systems, right?
Yeah, the teaching paradigms.
Right. So the AI MLOps guide outlines three primary ones. The first is supervised learning. And instead of the old tech cliche of flashcards, let's imagine you were handed a million historical emails.
Okay, I like this.
Right. And half of them have this bright red sticker that says spam, and the other half have a green sticker that says safe. And you just feed all these into the machine.
Right, so the machine's job in that scenario is basically to act as a detective. It analyzes the text, the sender, the time of day, and it mathematically maps those inputs to the known outcome.
The sticker.
Exactly, the sticker. It is trying to find the universal function that separates spam from safe so that, when a brand new unseen email arrives tomorrow, it can accurately predict which sticker belongs on it.
Okay, so the human provides the answer key for the training phase.
Yep.
Then we have the second paradigm, which is reinforcement learning. I usually hear this described as like training a dog with treats.
Right, the classic analogy.
Yeah, but the guide points out it is heavily used in complex robotics and gaming.
Yeah.
So let's picture a video game character trying to navigate a maze.
Okay, so in this case, the agent, the video game character, is dropped into a dynamic environment with absolutely zero knowledge of the rules.
None at all.
None. It learns through pure trial and error, takes a step left, falls into a pit, and receives a mathematical penalty. Right. But then next time, it takes a step right, finds a coin, and receives a numerical reward. So it constantly updates its internal policy to maximize its cumulative reward over time.
Okay, based on continuous feedback from the environment.
Exactly.
So it's just grinding through millions of permutations until it finds the optimal path. That makes sense. But the third pillar, unsupervised learning, that seems completely different.
It is very different.
Because there are no labeled emails, there are no rewards or penalties. You're just dumping a massive database into the system and telling it to like figure it out.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, unsupervised learning is arguably the most critical for cutting-edge business intelligence today.
Really? More than the others?
Oh, absolutely. Because it operates entirely on unlabeled data, its sole purpose is to uncover hidden structures, correlations, or, intrinsic groupings that human analysts are just completely blind to.
Yeah.
You aren't predicting a predefined outcome, you are exploring the unknown.
What does that actually look like, though? I mean, if it doesn't know what it's looking for, how does it find anything?
Well, let's use customer behavior as an example. Say you have a database of 1 million shoppers, but no neat labels telling you who is a bargain hunter or who is a brand loyalist.
Just a giant spreadsheet of raw data.
Right. So an unsupervised algorithm, like k-means clustering, approaches this geographically. It plots every single customer on a massive multidimensional graph based on their age, spending, visit frequency, things like that.
Okay.
Then it drops random pins into this graph and measures which customers are physically closest to which pins.
Oh, so it's grouping them by mathematical proximity.
Precisely. It iteratively moves those pins around until it finds distinct, really tight clusters of customers who behave almost identically.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it doesn't know what to call the cluster like. A human has to look at it later and say, ah, this group only buys diapers at 2 a.m. But the algorithm found that hidden structure completely on its own.
That is fascinating. So for you listening, the takeaway here is that you don't just pick a learning style at random. Supervised is for predicting known outcomes. Reinforcement is for navigating dynamic environments. And unsupervised is for discovering hidden patterns.
Right. The learning paradigm must align entirely with the nature of the data you actually possess.
All right. So we know the teaching methods. Let's pop the hood and look at the engines of intelligence. The actual algorithm.
This is the fun part.
Yeah. The guide highlights three heavy hitters, starting with decision trees. And I have to push back a little on this one.
Oh.
Yeah. When I look at a decision tree, it honestly seems like a simple game of 20 questions. Like, is the animal a mammal? Yes.
Yeah.
Does it have stripes? No. I mean, how can a basic flowchart be considered advanced machine learning?
Well, what's fascinating here is the mechanism behind how it chooses those questions.
What do you mean?
So, a human playing 20 questions guesses pretty randomly, right? But a decision tree algorithm mathematically evaluates every single feature in your data set to find the one specific question that most perfectly splits the data into distinct groups.
Oh, so it's not random at all?
Not at all. It uses metrics like information gain to mathematically reduce uncertainty at every single branch of the tree.
Okay, so it's not just a flowchart. It's a mathematically optimized path of interrogation.
Exactly. And that transparent, rule-based structure means you can actually interpret the logic easily. If a bank denies your loan using a decision tree, they can trace the exact path down the tree to tell you exactly why.
Which you can't always do with other models.
Right. Plus, decision trees are the foundation for ensemble methods. A single tree might, you know, overfit to the data and make weird predictions.
Right.
But if you use an algorithm called a random forest, you generate hundreds of different decision trees, feed them slightly different slices of data, and have them all vote on the final outcome.
Wow. It's like the wisdom of the crowd, but applied to algorithms.
Yes, exactly.
But what happens when the data is incredibly messy? Because a flowchart works if you can draw a clean line, but real-world data is rarely that simple. Which brings us to the second algorithm in the guide, support vector machines, or SVMs.
Yeah. Support vector machines are designed for classification, and their goal is to find the absolute optimal decision boundary, which is called a hyperplane, that separates different classes of data.
Okay.
And it does this with the maximum possible margin of safety between those classes.
I'm going to need you to try and paint a picture of that for me, because hyperplane sounds intimidating.
Okay. Imagine a table covered in a completely random mixture of red M&Ms and blue M&Ms.
Sounds delicious.
Right. Your goal is to separate them, but you can't draw a straight line anywhere on the table that perfectly divides the red from the blue. They are just too mixed up.
So a simple linear model would fail completely there.
It would. But an SVM uses something called a kernel function. It essentially hits the table from underneath, launching all the M&Ms into the air, which projects the data into a higher mathematical dimension.
Wait, really? It adds a dimension?
Mathematically, yes. And while they are suspended in midair, a clear gap suddenly appears between the red and blue clusters. The SVM then slides a flat sheet of paper, that's the hyperplane, right through that gap.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when everything lands back on the table, you have a perfect, complex, curved boundary separating your data.
That is an incredible way to visualize it. It finds a solution in three dimensions that was literally impossible in two.
Exactly.
Okay. And then we have the rock stars of the whole industry. Neural networks. I have to ask, are these literally artificial brains, or is that just marketing hype?
Honestly, it is mostly marketing.
I knew it.
I mean, they are loosely inspired by biological neurons, sure, but mechanically, we really need to view them as interconnected layers of artificial nodes processing data hierarchically. You have an input layer, multiple hidden layers in the middle, and an output layer.
Okay, let's break down those hidden layers. How do they actually transform the data?
Think about facial recognition. The input layer just sees raw pixels, right? Just numbers representing color and brightness.
Right.
The first hidden layer looks at those pixels and learns to identify really simple edges and lines. It then passes that information to the next layer, which combines those edges to identify basic shapes like circles or curves.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Yeah, and then the final hidden layer combines those shapes to recognize complex features, like an eye or a nose.
Oh, it's a hierarchy of abstraction, like each layer builds on the work of the previous one.
Exactly. And fueled by massive data sets and modern computational hardware like GPUs, neural networks excel at extracting these abstract features directly from raw data. They are the absolute backbone of deep learning, powering everything from advanced computer vision to large language models.
Okay, so we have these incredibly powerful engines. Decision trees for transparent logic, SVMs for complex spatial boundaries, and neural networks for deep hierarchical abstraction.
Right.
But here's where it gets really interesting. An engine, no matter how advanced it is, will completely choke if you feed it contaminated fuel.
Oh, absolutely.
Which brings us to the gritty reality of a data scientist's day-to-day. Data pre-processing and exploratory data analysis, or EDA.
Yeah, this step actually takes up the vast majority of a machine learning project's timeline. It's not the glamorous part, but it's essential.
I like to think of raw data like an archaeological dig site. You know, you've got half-broken pottery, missing pieces, dirt everywhere.
That's a great analogy.
You can't just throw that straight into a pristine museum display case.
Okay.
And according to the AIML OPS guide, real-world data is plagued with missing values. So say we have a spreadsheet of 100,000 patients and some are missing their blood pressure readings. Do we just like delete those rows?
Well, this raises an important question about bias. You have to be very careful with deletion.
Why is that?
Because throwing data away is only acceptable if the missingness is truly minimal and completely random. If, say, a certain demographic was just less likely to have their blood pressure recorded, deleting those rows means your model will completely ignore that demographic.
Oh, wow. So you've built a biased algorithm before it even started learning.
Exactly. You've skewed reality.
So if we can't delete the missing pieces, how do we fill them in without just, you know, making things up?
We use a process called imputation. Sometimes we use basic statistical imputation, which is just filling the blank with the mathematical mean or median of that specific column.
Okay, simple enough.
But a much more sophisticated method is model-based imputation, like k-nearest neighbors or KNN.
Wait, how does that work mechanically?
Okay, so if a patient is missing a blood pressure reading, the KNN algorithm searches the entire database for the five patients who are most mathematically identical to this person based on every other metric.
Like their age, weight, cholesterol, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It finds those five nearest neighbors, averages their blood pressure, and uses that highly educated guess to fill in the blank for the original patient.
Okay, so we've filled the holes, but the guide also hammers home the absolute necessity of scaling the data.
Yes, very important.
But why does it matter if my data is measured in millions of dollars versus single-digit percentages?
Yeah.
Doesn't the computer just read numbers?
It does, but underneath all the hype, these algorithms are just highly advanced calculators, right? They optimize based on numerical magnitude.
Meaning the size of the number matters.
Exactly. If you feed a neural network a data set where age is typically around 30 and salary is typically around 100,000, the algorithm is going to look at those numbers and assume that salary is thousands of times more important than age simply because the raw number is larger.
Ah, which would completely destroy the model's logic. So how do we level the playing field?
We scale it mathematically. There are two main ways. Normalization, which is often called min-max scaling, takes every single feature and squishes the values down so they fall on a fixed scale exactly between 0 and 1.
So the oldest person becomes a 1, the youngest becomes a 0, and everyone else is a decimal in between.
Exactly. And that's great for neural networks. But there's also standardization, or Z-score scaling, which centers the data around a mean of 0. That one is crucial for things like SVMs and linear regression. Both methods force the algorithm to treat all features with equal weight initially.
Okay, but what about outliers? Like the one person in the data set making $1 billion a year. If we squish the data from 0 to 1, that billionaire becomes the 1, and every normal person gets crushed down to like 0.000001.
Yeah, that is exactly why outlier detection is mandatory before you scale anything. You have to find those anomalies first.
How do you do that?
You might use statistical boundaries, like measuring how many standard deviations a point is away from the mean, or use isolation algorithms. Once they're found, domain experts have to decide whether to remove that billionaire from the data set entirely, or perhaps apply a logarithmic transformation to mathematically shrink that massive gap between them and the rest of the normal data.
It sounds like rigorous quality control. But before we ever hit train on the model, the guide emphasizes exploratory data analysis. It sounds like this is where data scientists get to literally visualize the terrain they're working with.
EDA is absolutely crucial. You aren't modeling yet. You are just looking at the data.
Just getting a feel for it.
Yeah, you use histograms to understand the distribution of a single variable. Like, is most of our customer base in their 20s, or is it evenly spread out? You use scatter plots to visualize the relationship between two variables, looking for obvious visual trends.
And the guide mentions heat maps for multivariate analysis, right?
Yes, heat maps act like an X-ray of your entire data set, highlighting correlations. If two variables are highly correlated, say a house's square footage and the number of bedrooms, the heat map glows brightly in that exact spot.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it tells the data scientist that they might only need to feed one of those features into the model, which saves computational power and reduces noise.
It's like studying a topographical map before you start building a road. You see the mountains and rivers before you ever break ground.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've chosen our learning paradigm. We've picked our mathematical engine. We've meticulously cleaned the archaeological dig site of our data. And we've mapped the terrain with EDA. The model trains. Now we reach the absolute moment of truth. Model evaluation.
Right. This is where we uncover if the model actually learned to generalize to the real world, or if it just memorized the training data.
Which is that fatal flaw known as overfitting, right?
Exactly. Memorizing the past doesn't help you predict the future.
So we test it on unseen data that we held back. But I want to push back on a very common assumption here. Let's say we test our model, and the dashboard says it achieved 99% accuracy on that unseen data. Isn't that a total victory? I mean, why does the guide suggest that accuracy can sometimes be a terrible, misleading metric?
Oh, that is the ultimate trap in data science, particularly in risk-sensitive domains. Let's use fraud detection as an example.
Okay.
You are building a model to flag fraudulent credit card transactions. And historically, only 1% of transactions are actual fraud.
Right. Okay. So 99% are perfectly normal, legitimate transactions.
Exactly. A completely useless, lazy algorithm could be programmed to just confidently predict not fraud for every single transaction 100% of the time.
Wait. Oh, wow. Because 99% of the data is actually not fraud, the model's accuracy score would technically be 99%.
Exactly. The executives pop the champagne for a 99% accurate model while the bank is actively losing millions of dollars because the system caught absolutely zero fraud.
That is terrifying.
It is. This is exactly why evaluating classification models requires a confusion matrix. It forces you to break down the predictions into true positives, true negatives, false positives, and false negatives.
Okay, so we abandon accuracy as the ultimate metric. What metrics do we actually use to understand those four categories?
We use much more nuanced metrics, specifically precision and recall. Precision asks, out of all the cases the model flagged as fraud, how many were actually fraud?
No.
A model with low precision is basically the boy who cried wolf it, flags everything, annoying your customers with constant false alarms.
And what about recall?
Recall asks, out of all the actual fraud happening in the real world, how much did our model successfully catch? A model with low recall is like a sleeping security guard. It might not annoy customers with false alarms, but criminals are just walking right past it.
So it's a balancing act. Like, if you are building a medical diagnostic tool for a fatal disease, you want incredibly high recall, right? You want to catch every single potential case, even if it means a few false positives that require a second test.
Precisely. But if you are building a spam filter for emails, you want high precision. Users will totally tolerate a spam email sneaking into their inbox every now and then, but they will be furious if a critical email from their boss gets falsely flagged and sent to the junk folder.
Right. That makes total sense. Mm-hmm. And the guide mentions the F1 score, which is basically a mathematical balance, the harmonic mean between precision and recall. It gives you a single metric to track when you need to balance both priorities on a highly imbalanced data set.
Yes. It's very useful.
But what if we aren't classifying things into categories? What if we are predicting a continuous number, like tomorrow's stock price or the value of a house?
Ah, that is a regression task, and we evaluate those entirely differently. We measure the continuous error. So Mean absolute error, or MAE, simply averages the magnitude of the model's mistakes.
Okay, so if it guesses a house price is $10,000 off and another is $20,000 off, it just averages those misses. But the guide also mentions root mean squared error, or RMSE. Wait, why would we square the error? I mean, if my model is off by $10 twice, isn't that mathematically the same as being off by $20 once?
In a simple math problem on a chalkboard, yes. But in a real-world system, absolutely not.
Really?
Yeah. A bunch of tiny errors are usually just harmless noise. But a single massive error like predicting a house is worth $1 million more than it actually is could bankrupt an investment firm.
Oh, I see.
Right. So RMSE squares the errors before averaging them, which mathematically applies a massive penalty to large mistakes. It literally forces the algorithm to prioritize avoiding catastrophic extreme errors over just being perfectly average.
Wow. So what does this all mean for you listening? As we pull this entire journey together, the overarching theme from the AI MLOPS Master's Guide is brilliantly clear. Machine learning is not magic.
Not at all.
It's not a sentient black box that just conjures answers out of thin air. It is an incredibly rigorous, structured process.
It is an engineering discipline through and through.
Yeah. It requires choosing the exact right learning paradigm based on your specific data. It requires selecting a mathematical engine, whether a transparent decision tree or a complex neural network, that fits your goal. It demands obsessive data cleaning to avoid bias, and it relies on context-aware evaluation metrics that look past the illusion of simple accuracy.
Well said.
Whether you are actively aiming for a role as a data scientist or you just want to clearly understand the invisible forces shaping your industry, this framework is your starting point. And the guide even notes that Python is the universally preferred language to start experimenting with these concepts yourself.
Yeah, the barrier to entry to actually use the tools is lower than ever today. But the intuition, like understanding why an algorithm behaves the way it does and how to measure its blind spots, is what will actually set you apart in the industry.
Absolutely.
Which, you know, brings to mind one final lingering question based on everything we've broken down today.
Yeah.
Well, we established right at the start that machine learning models are inherently designed to map and find patterns in historical data, right?
Right.
They learn entirely from what has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
So if we increasingly rely on these models to govern our global supply chains, our financial markets, and, you know, even our medical resource allocation,
yeah.
How can we ever trust them to predict, manage, or even recognize an entirely unprecedented novel black swan event? If something has absolutely no historical equivalent in the training data, the algorithm is entirely blind to it.
Wow. I mean, you can't write a rule for something that has never existed.
Right.
And an algorithm can't find a pattern for an event that has never happened.
Exactly.
It really brings us right back to where we started, doesn't it? If the instruction manual is gone and historical data is all we have, well, what happens when the world faces a situation that simply isn't on the box? Something for you to ponder until next time.